World War II gave the world a lot of firsts and biggests, few of them the kinds of things we like to celebrate. The record includes the greatest maritime disaster in history, the loss of 9,000 people from the sinking of a refugee ship. The torpedo sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff is the central event in the historical novel Salt to the Sea by Ruta Sepetys. She made the New York Times bestseller list with Between Shades of Gray in 2011. It will soon appear on screen as Ashes in the Snow. Ruta is also the author of Out of the Easy. Her books have been translated into more than 30 languages. Ruta was raised in Michigan and lives in Nashville. Ruta Sepetys, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's no glossing over atrocities. We get our first dead body on page 2 of Salt to the Sea. I mean, talk about how you were drawn to this particular story.
Yeah, I get right to it. And in terms of how I was drawn to it, I am the daughter of a refugee. My father fled from Lithuania and spent 9 years in refugee camps. And his cousin also fled, but she did not make it into refugee camps. She was caught in this area that I talk about in the novel, East Prussia. And my father's cousin was granted passage on this ship, the Wilhelm Gustloff. And that's how I know about the story.
Wow. Do you feel some sense of duty to tell the stories of the victims of the war?
Well, I do. And, you know, my father's cousin, the day of the voyage, fate intervened, and she was not able to get on the ship. And she made me realize that sometimes it's not where we are, it's where we aren't that makes a difference. And she wasn't on the ship, but yet she's affecting change. She was the one who urged me, who begged me to write about it.
Wow. And it's an amazing story in and of itself. I was just looking at the numbers again. 9,400 people believed to have died when the Wilhelm Gustloff went down out of more than 10,000 aboard, which seems like an incredibly full ship. We'll get to that in a bit. But just a horrific loss of life. And in the middle of this, you give us four main characters. Tell us about them and how you shaped them.
Well, because there were so many different regions and countries that were affected by the war, I wanted to give voice to those different regions, and so I created four characters: a Lithuanian nurse, an East Prussian art thief, a young Polish girl, and a German sailor who is sort of our eyes and ears onto the ship. And their fates converge as they make their way to the port and board the doomed Wilhelm Gustloff.
The shifting between the characters is rapid. I mean, we're talking a couple of pages at most for us to get inside the heads of each of these. Talk about the reason for the techniques and how it affects you as a writer having to change viewpoints so quickly.
Thanks for asking that. It was a challenge because I wanted readers to know whose head and voice they were in without even seeing the name at the chapter head. So as a result, the voices had to be very distinct and very different. The short chapters, I wanted there to be a sense of emotional immediacy as the reader is reading this. When I met with survivors and did some research, people were literally breathless as they were explaining, about the and describing this experience. And I wanted to convey that to the reader, and that was the reason for four different points of view in short chapters.
And so we get to see incidents from a couple of different sides, and in fact, the word bang is used several times in the opening 10 pages as things happen. I'm not going to go into too much detail here. Don't wreck it for the reader. But you get to see these incidents from different sides, and it's really interesting in that respect. And, of course, because these people come from different areas, they can't speak to each other in some cases.
Correct. But yet they found ways to communicate, and, war made them a family.
To what extent, then, are the characters based on real people, Ruta?
Well, because I write fiction, I have the benefit of being able to interview, let's say, 20 to 100 people and weave their stories together. So they're definitely based on real people, but I've woven several stories of one person, of several stories into, let's say, the character of the nurse, or several stories of soldiers into the character of the East Prussian art thief.
Who's Florian, and we have Joanna, the Lithuanian nurse, Amelia, the Polish girl, and Alfred, the German sailor. These are actually well drawn out characters, and Alfred in particular, not because of who he is, but because of where he is, as you pointed out, really is our eyes onto the ship itself.
Exactly. And Alfred is also a study of visibility. What happens to a young person who is previously passed over for everything, rejected, invisible? But then he's given a uniform, and suddenly he becomes visible. What happens to that young man?
We get to see his growth. Characters aside, I mean, how difficult is it to, even though you've heard the stories for many years, how difficult to imagine and recreate the deprivations suffered by war refugees?
It's extremely difficult, especially because it affected my own family. My father lost his family, his country, his language, his flag, and yet these people, you know, have described to me that, you know, no one can take your spirit. And so I tried to balance hope and horror in writing Salt to the Sea and try to explain that there is strength to be found through suffering.
Were you intentionally writing for a young adult audience with Salt to the Sea?
Yes, I do write for a young adult audience. I'm considered a crossover author. My books are read both by teens and adults, but these are hidden pieces of history, and I want them, you know, to be read by young people. Young people are deep thinkers, and they're deep feelers, and books we read when we're young, they make a profound impact on us and stay with us forever.
Anything about your approach change in telling this story because you're writing for a slightly younger audience?
No, actually, I don't censor my writing, and I certainly don't write down for young people. Like I said, they're very, very savvy readers.
The book is called Salt to the Sea. It's a novel, but based on a very, very real event during World War II, the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, with the loss of 9,400 lives in early 1945. Ruta Sepetys is the author of the book and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her, and you can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Ruta Sepetys and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the author Ruta Sepetys. She has been on the New York Times bestseller list earlier with Between Shades of Grey. She's also the author of Out of the Easy. Her latest book is called Salt to the Sea, a historical novel that revolves around the sinking of the refugee ship Wilhelm Gustloff in the closing months of World War II with the loss of 9,000 lives. She tells the story first person through four different people, a Lithuanian woman, a Prussian man, a Polish girl, and a German officer. You can join us, a German sailor, I should say. Join us on The Exchange with questions or comments, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You know, I began to wonder, because, you know, horrible things happen in this book. We are talking refugees on the run, and then ultimately this large event where so many people die. But the book is told first person, and I wonder, Ruta, if that actually helped not to have a third-person viewpoint, because it makes the descriptions of the horrors sparer.
It helped me, even in writing it. Again, I wanted to express a sense of emotional immediacy. And so generally, I write as I research. I don't research and set it aside and then go back and write the novel. I do it simultaneously. And I think writing in first person does bring a sense of immediacy.
How much revision then through that process? Then, I mean, do you find out things later in the research and go, oh man, now I got to go back and change those first two chapters?
Absolutely. And that's the fun part of it. I often say that I'm more of a reviser than a writer. I write dozens of drafts of my novels. And really, for me, writing is a team sport. It's not only me, but the people that are helping me research and the survivors and their families and historians and academics.
You really get into the backstories of the people and in a sense, help us mourn the old lives they lost. I'm particularly struck by something Joanna said in a moment of self-reflection where she says, I had the highest marks in school, but I couldn't master common sense.
And that was something that so many survivors related to me, that they could have had a tremendous skill set prior to the war. But at that time, you know, once the war began and as it you know, raged on, those skill sets really didn't matter, that everyone was on, to some extent, a level playing field.
I have to wonder about how intimate or intricate the research got with the likes of the shoe poet, the guy who can tell so much about a person just by looking at their shoes.
The shoe poet is one of my favorite characters. So we have these four young people, and yet The shoe poet is an elderly man, and he's the voice of wisdom. He's a lamplighter of hope and inspiration. And in order to create the shoe poet, I had to study shoes and shoemaking and foot drafts. And I wanted to convey that knowledge through this older character of the shoe poet.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun, the stuff that he comes up with. But you know, apart from the relationships that are a building as this is all going on, I mean, you give a good sense of the chaos here. I mean, really, what happened to people who were caught fleeing if they were caught by the authorities in whatever region they were in?
Well, and this is a story that many aren't, you know, familiar with, that near the end of World War II, you know, there were millions of refugees who were trapped between the Germans and the Russians, and they were forced to leave everything they'd ever known and loved behind. And what is that like? And I'm familiar with that because of my own father's experience, but I don't think many people are familiar with the plight of the refugee. And so it's something that I wanted to capture in this novel, never knowing that when the book, you know, would be published, that we would be amidst a refugee crisis ourselves.
Right. I was going to ask you whether that entered at all into the process, but it sounds like you were pretty much done with the book by the time that began.
Correct. I was done.
Mm-hmm. In those days, different time in history, you know, no internet, stuff like that. How hard was it to get good information, like, for example, where the front was?
It was extremely difficult to get good information. And as you can imagine, rumors ran absolutely wild, you know, and one person would hear something, and then in telling another person, they would change it just slightly. And then the Germans, they were issuing all of this blustery propaganda, assuring, you know, people that, that victory was theirs and they would be the victors. And also the Germans forbid people to evacuate until the very last minute. And that was so tragic. So many people lost their lives because they weren't permitted to evacuate.
And some of the things that people are driven to, I'm particularly struck by the people asking each other for poison in case of capture. Was that something that did in fact happen?
It did happen. And some of these people in their memoirs recounted that they carried poison with them just in case things were so terrifying. And one person relayed that they saw a man on the side of the road so hungry that he was eating a candle. And I think these are things that really stuck with me and that I wanted to, you know, incorporate into the book.
Ruta Sepeti is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Salt to the Sea. It's a novel about the sinking of a refugee ship in the latter days of World War II. There's a level of alienation you portray here, Ruta. I mean, it's people needing help but not wanting to ask for it, wanting to have companionship but avoiding it. I mean, how do you wrap your mind around these circumstances enough to write?
Exactly. Sometimes it's emotionally so overwhelming, and people often ask, you know, do I have to step away from it? And actually, the answer is no. I try to stay present within it in order to be able to convey the horror and the tragedy of what is going on. And as I'm writing these stories, especially about this story about the Wilhelm Gustloff, I mean, it makes me wonder, what determines how history is preserved and recalled? And why is it that some parts of history penetrate our collective consciousness, you know, while others remain hidden? And that's what's hardest for me to wrap my head around.
Yeah, I guess I'm struck as I think about it by the fact that we're talking 9,400 people died in the sinking of this one ship sunk by Soviet torpedoes, not very far from shore from the sounds of it. And yet, when you think about the other things that happened in 1945, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and countless other battles, this is why stuff like the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff can get lost in history.
Yeah, you're right. And even though the sinking of the Gustloff, you know, the death toll dwarfs the Titanic and the Lusitania combined, somehow it's a story that, you know, history has opted to forget.
So how many accounts of the Wilhelm Gustloff did you have to pour over to get a real sense of what happened there?
Well, you know, historical fiction sits on the shoulders of nonfiction and memoir and testimony, and I was so fortunate that there was a journalist, Catherine Prince, who wrote a book called Death in the Baltic, and that came out last year. And that's a nonfiction book that some of your listeners might be interested in. And Catherine had done so much research, and she worked with me and shared her findings with me. And so that really saved me a lot of time. And of course, I had to speak to some people myself. But I really rely very heavily on historians, academics, and nonfiction.
What was the original reason for the ship to sail, and from which port was it sailing?
The ship sailed from, at the time, what was Gotenhafen, Germany, which is now Poland, Gdynia, Poland, and it sailed because there was this evacuation that was called Operation Hannibal, and it happened in January of 1945, and the Germans knew that they were losing, and they had to evacuate. So they commandeered ships and floating vessels of all shapes and sizes, and one that they commandeered was this former cruise ship, the Wilhelm Gustloff, and it was just sailing from Gotenhafen to Kiel, Germany, which was a 48-hour voyage.
Now, the Gustloff itself was apparently quite the luxury liner in its heyday before the war.
Well, yes, it was a cruise ship, but it was advertised as a ship for the everyman. Every cabin was a single-class cabin, except one, Hitler's cabin. And by the time that the Gustloff sailed during Operation Hannibal, it hadn't sailed for 4 years. It had been in port used as a hospital ship and later as naval barracks for personnel.
Okay, so set it up for us. Who was aboard the ship on that final voyage?
Well, on the final voyage, which took place January 30th, 1945, and keep in mind that the ship sailed during a snowstorm, and this was not a cruise for leisure. It was a cruise for life. And amongst the capacity of the ship was 1,400, and when it sailed, it was carrying over 10,000 people. And of course, you know, the priority were Nazi Party leaders and you know, German soldiers and wounded Germans. But that only took up perhaps 1,000 people, and the remaining 9,000 people, they were refugees. And three torpedoes, 60 minutes to sink, and 9,343 people to the bottom of the sea, including 5,000 teenagers and children. It is the single largest maritime disaster in history.
How did the refugees know to head for Gotenhafen to get aboard the ship?
Well, going back to your point about exchanging information and how information was shared, word got out that there were ships that were sailing from the port and that they were taking children and refugees. And so my father's cousin, for example, who was on the run at that time, heard whispers of this through the crowds, and everybody simply made their way to the port. And can you imagine the chaos as hundreds of thousands of desperate human beings descended upon this port, desperate to get on one of these ships?
Ruta Sepetys is again our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her novel is Salt to the Sea, about the 1945 sinking of the refugee ship Wilhelm Gustloff. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm still struck by the numbers alone, 10,000 people on a ship that was set up for 1,400, and not a Titanic-sized ship. I mean, what were the conditions on board like?
I'm so glad you brought that up. No, the ship was much smaller, actually, than the Titanic. And in order to make room for these refugees, the Germans removed every bit of furniture from the ship, all the tables, all the chairs. They even drained the swimming pool, and there were people that were shoulder to shoulder in the swimming pool in order you know, to accommodate more refugees and more personnel.
Wow. How crammed in were these people? I mean, it sounds like every single portion of the ship would have been taken up.
Absolutely. Every square inch of the ship was taken. And as you can imagine, there were children who were traveling alone with nothing but an address pinned to their coat. And it became extremely hot in the ship. And so some people took off their coats. They took off their life vests. And people were so ill because the ship sailed during a terrible snowstorm. People were so seasick. And then, you know, when the torpedoes struck, many people didn't have their life vest on. And imagine the desperate surge of 9,000 people trying to make their way, 10,000, up the stairwells to the top of the ship, and 10 of the lifeboats were missing, and there weren't enough lifeboats. It was pure chaos.
In addition to that, the snow and ice apparently had something to do with the ice boats that were available, the lifeboats that were available for use.
It did. The ropes to some of the lifeboats were frozen, and I spoke to a woman who lives in Georgia. She's a survivor, and she and her mother pushed up the stairway and got up to the top deck, and there was one lifeboat left, and her mother put her in it, and the girl was in the lifeboat looking up at her mother on deck saying, "Mama, get in the boat." And they had lost sight of her brother, and the woman would not get in the boat, and the poor girl was screaming, "Mama, please get in the boat." And they were sawing away at the frozen ropes on the lifeboat, and the boat dropped into the water, and the girl was in the boat, and her mom was up on deck, and that is the last time she saw her mother as the ship rolled over onto its side into the sea.
Oh, boy. It's just amazing that the stories that come out of something like this. Ice and snow aside, what were the war conditions of that part of the Baltic at that time? What was lying ahead of the Wilhelm Gustloff as it left Gotenhafen?
Well, the Russians were pushing into this region of East Prussia. And at this point, the Germans knew they were losing the war, but they wouldn't admit it. They kept issuing this propaganda. And as a result, many people perished, as the Russians came in. So it was a very desperate time.
So I'm just trying to figure out, though, did the Soviets come along the lines of thinking anything that comes out of a German port we are going to fire upon?
Oh, absolutely. And when the ship sailed, there was argument over whether they should sail with their lights on because they were concerned that the Soviet planes would bomb them from above. And in fact, during these refugee treks, in order to make it to the port, there was a frozen lagoon that these refugees had to cross, and the Soviets were flying overhead and firing into the lagoon, and hundreds of people and their horse-drawn carts and their children were falling into the lagoon and drowning even before they got to the port. So yes, they were firing on anything and everything.
Wow. So they actually had to walk across the ice of the lagoon in the first place, is what you're saying.
Exactly, and many didn't even make that. A woman told me that her grandmother paused on the side of the road to rest and froze to death. It's so, so tragic.
What did the sub itself manage to finish out the war intact? It sounds like some of the accounts of what happened to the Wilhelm Gustloff are known because of the survival of the people aboard the submarine.
Well, the submarine, yes, it also torpedoed another ship during the war. Yet afterward, the submarine commander was dishonorably discharged by the Soviets, and he himself was sent to Siberia. Later in life, he was released from Siberia and made a war hero. But because he was dishonorably discharged, some historians believe that's another reason that this story isn't well known. You know, after the war, the Germans weren't talking about it. They didn't feel it was appropriate to position themselves as victims, considering the atrocities of the Nazis during the war. And then the Russians weren't talking about it either because they had to deal with this dishonorable, submarine commander.
Wow. So I mean, it would have been an act of war. It would have been a war crime to fire on a refugee ship, wouldn't it, if they had known?
Well, the Wilhelm Gustloff was armed, and for many years there was debate over whether it was a war crime, and then it was determined that no, because the ship was armed, because it was carrying 100 U-boat commanders, and it was carrying Nazi soldiers, that it was a fair target.
Oh, really? Wow, that's amazing.
So tragic.
Truly. I'm not going to give away the fate of the main characters because, you know, you want people to read the book, but wow. I mean, normally when you shift from character to character, again, it's all in first person through the four main characters, Joanna, Florian, Amelia, and Alfred. They get a page or two. They get a single sentence as the worst moment approaches, and that's a really impactful technique.
Oh, thank you. And actually, I can't take credit for that. When I was interviewing people who survived this refugee experience, often they would only be able to speak one sentence. They were so emotional. And so as I was looking through my notebook, often a page would contain only a single sentence. And so I decided to then put that into the novel that way.
Wow, it's pretty amazing work, and it tells an amazing story that would have stood even as factual by itself, which is the sinking of the refugee ship Wilhelm Gustloff in January of 1945. Portrayed through the eyes of four young people in Ruta Sepeti's book Salt to the Sea, which is out there for sale now. Ruta, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey.
Great to have you. I also want to give some thanks here to Max Cole, our research intern, for helping come up with questions for Ruta.